Hello, everyone. Thanks so much for joining us for this panel. My name is Maria Garcia. I'm the senior editor of The Artery at WBUR. That's WBUR's arts and culture team, and I'm so thrilled to be in the company of such extraordinary thinkers and writers. And I'll let you all introduce yourselves and your book.
Great. Well, good morning, everybody. Thank you for coming out. Louder? A little bit louder? Great, thanks. Good morning, and thank you so much for coming out to join us for this conversation. And I want to thank Maria for facilitating this conversation and for my other panelists. I am an assistant professor at Brown University, and this year I'm on a Carnegie Fellowship, conducting more research on the histories of racial violence on the U.S.-Mexico border. And so my book, The Injustice Never Leaves You, Anti-Mexican Violence in Texas, is a history of a period of state-sanctioned racial terror that targeted ethnic Mexicans. So this included American citizens and Mexican nationals that were living in Texas. And it's a period of terror that's largely been forgotten in the national public imaginary. But this history really shaped community relations, culture, cultures of policing and politics in Texas, and the reverberations of this period of violence continue to shape how people today think about the border, immigrants, policing, and justice. And so the book documents this period of violence at the hands of vigilantes, Texas Rangers, the state police force, U.S. soldiers, and local law enforcement. And it traces the, not only documents the acts of violence, but it also traces how those events impacted communities. And so I'm also a historian that's committed to trying to reckon with violence, and so have worked with museums and the Texas Historical Commission and teachers to try to make this history public. So actively engaged in documenting the history, but then also finding ways to stimulate public understanding that has a truthful account of this period of violence, and trying to figure out how that can shape public understandings of immigration policies and policing today. Because although this violence that I studied primarily took place over 100 years ago, we're living in the midst of another immigration crisis, humanitarian crisis on the border and across the country. And of course, the cultures of violent policing impact people across the country. So I'm looking forward to the conversation and answering some questions.
Mm-hmm. Good morning. How's my volume? Can I be heard? Okay. All right. I'm also very happy to be here with Maria and Monica and Laura, and looking forward to the conversation. My name's Jabari Yassim. I direct the graduate program in creative writing at Emerson College. I've written 9 books for children and 6 books for adults. I often write about social justice and race. My new book, We Can't Breathe, is a collection of essays primarily addressing the experience of inhabiting a black body in spaces like this one, in which I am one of a handful of dark bodies, and in some ways automatically become a representative black body, and what that experience is like, but not just in actual geographic space, but also in metaphorical space is what I explore in the book. So looking forward to talking about it.
Hi, everyone. My name is Laura Weiss-Munoz. Also very grateful to be here. And I really was inspired to write this book. I had been covering immigration in different forms for more than a decade, and felt a little bit like I was banging my head against the wall, writing for the same audience, same short stories, you know, feeding the beast day in, day out. And at the same time had watched this burgeoning movement, this civil rights movement, growing up before my eyes of these young people who were in the country, living here illegally. They were undocumented, but were in a country that they had grown up speaking the language, had said the Pledge of Allegiance every day in school, had, you know, identified with this culture, and then basically when they turned 18, it was a country that sought to render them as ghosts. And they protested, and they said they would not turn into ghosts, and they stood up. And it was a time, I grew up in the 80s, and it felt like sort of a cynical time. And this was a group that had taken action, not in spite not with the absence of fear, but in spite of it. And I was inspired to see their action. And not only that, but also the interweaving between what they were doing and how they were soon learning to work across with other movements, LGBTQ, the burgeoning Black Lives Matter movement, and looking at how all of these different movements informed one another. And it was during a dark time for them when coming out as undocumented, even for a youth, even a privileged youth, one of the people I follow went to Harvard, even for those students, they did not have any protections. It was a very dark, scary time. And since then, they've had protections, and it feels like it's been an easier thing for them to be seen and heard. But I wanted to remind people of where they started, where they came from, and especially in this moment where it is a much scarier time for many immigrants in this country. I wanted to show and inspire, and I also, for people who aren't immigrants and even aren't people of color, but who are young and want to be engaged in our civic society, and I wanted to show what happens when people come together and fight and engage with the system. Mm-hmm. And so that was the birth of The Making of a Dream.
Thank you to all three of you. I want to get to a connecting theme, a connecting thread in all of your books, and that's that you really seek the hidden narratives that have been purposely obscured from the conventional historical narrative in the U.S. For Monica, that was finding the oral histories, right, of people who had inherited trauma, inherited loss from this incredibly violent time of state-sanctioned terror, and these were accounts that were largely forgotten. For you, Jabari, it's the constant erasure of the legacy and the present legacy of racial violence against and racism against Black people in the U.S. And for you, Laura, it was humanizing these young people who, like you said, have been painted as ghosts, have been politicized, and have been given an image that very often serves the whatever political narrative is convenient at the moment. So I wonder if you can talk to me a little bit about the process of finding these narratives that not only have been forgotten, but that have been purposely and very deliberately obscured by the state and by the conventional narratives of history in the U.S. And I think we can start with you, Jabari, for this question.
Sure. I'm very interested in what I call narrative combat. You may recall Samuel Huntington's book a few years ago that talked about a clash of civilizations, a clash of cultures. I really tend to look at modern relations as a clash of stories. And I think particularly the systematic oppression of people, the oppressors get between the oppressed and their stories. So what I'm kind of interested in doing is leveraging that space open and sort of reclaiming that narrative, but also writing as a form of resistance that, okay, this is the dominant narrative, the state-sponsored narrative, if you will, and often the media-enabled narrative about people like me. But here's the actual story. So I always want to push back against that story because I think the side effect and the intended consequence is malignant, and I want to push back against that.
What about for you, Laura?
Well, I follow what Jabari said, but I think also for me as a journalist, it was very important. I feel like too often we want to put our heroes, our leaders, on a pedestal, and I feel like that does not only a disservice to those people who are putting their lives on the line and have this courage, but also to those who want to come in their footsteps, the other young people, because they think, how can I ever, you know, match this level of commitment, this lack of fear, of doubt, of lack of making mistakes? And so I wanted to create really honest and complex narratives that are true to our human experience, because I think that is more inspiring. And so I found that not only are the sort of power narratives that are shutting down other true narratives, but even within movements, there are times when people feel that it could be a disservice to sort of show, you know, our dirty laundry. And I actually think that the more complex the movement is, the more you see how many forces have to come together. And so, You know, one of my characters, he was about to commit, he tried to commit suicide before he led this march from Miami to Washington. And it was in part because he was undocumented and he felt so lost. It was also because he was queer and he didn't feel that he could come out about his identity. And that dual identity was very complex and also posed challenges within the movement. And I wanted to be able to tell all of that because that is the real story. That is the real America.
Well, as a historian, I'm really interested in the relationship between history and memory and power. And tracking in the chapters and the archival work that I did in my book, I was really interested in trying to show and expose that although this history has largely been forgotten in public, that there's a deep archival record to show and document these cases of violence. And the work that I did with families, descendants of violence, many of them have preserved family archives. They've preserved documents, family records, family photographs, but it, as a way of speaking back to the state archives in particular. So in looking at Texas Ranger reports and police records, for example, they frequently justified killings and shootings by explaining that people were shot because they were trying to escape arrest, or they just described the person that, that was killed as a Mexican bandit. And so that vast, that criminalization of ethnic Mexicans was so pervasive that you see it in the media reports and you see it in the legal records. And simply labeling somebody a bandit gave these police a culture of impunity. And so there was no public outrage on a national level. And locally, you know, the civil rights activists that were journalists that documented these killings, families and widows, children who tried to seek justice by filing court cases and claims against the United States government, those records exist, and they give us the names of people who were killed, and that gives us access to tracking the aftermath of violence. And so in my book, I include not only accounts of a lynching and of a double murder and of a massacre, for example, but then I trace the efforts and the strategies that were available for people to seek justice. And that was varied for different people, but it's a part of our history. Not only is the history of racial terror, state-sanctioned violence a part of our history, but so is the efforts to seek justice. And that's the work that the oral histories gave me access to. You know, a descendant could tell me about their grandmother that filed a court case against the United States government, and that allowed me to also tell a gendered history of this racial violence, because primarily young men were targeted for murder, but children, wives, neighbors witnessed these acts of terror. And so it gave me a chance to also write about how communities are shaped by what they witness and the kinds of terror that they have to navigate on a daily basis.
Mm-hmm. Particularly with your book and your book, Jabari, I think it reminded me that we can't trust official records, particularly of institutions that were created for the purpose of employing strategies for the benefit of white supremacy. And that's not, you know, that's not something that's up for interpretation. I mean, we know this from history that the Texas Rangers, for example, were a vigilante mob that was given legal authority by the state of Texas to suppress black and brown people in Texas. And there's a lot of talk about how police departments across the country are corrupt, are broken, but in fact we know that in fact they are working the way they were designed to work, which is for the benefit of landowning financial gain, of sort of white capitalist system in the U.S. So I wonder if you can talk about sort of that tension between the official record and the narratives now.
Yeah, I think it's interesting. You say there's no debate, and I agree with you. There's no disputing that. But even on the liberal side, when we look at liberal progressive responses, they're often along the lines of the system is broken. The system is broken. We need to fix the system, et cetera. And the system isn't broken. The system is working exactly the way it was designed, right? And so that's part of that narrative has to be pushed against as well. So yeah, that is continually part of of the struggle, you know, to sort of dispute what we call the official record. Toni Morrison calls it the master narrative, and she says, you know, it's not actually based on race, but it's based on power, as Laura identified. It exists to enable people in power to stay in power at the expense of the powerless. But you can draw a line historically between those early slave patrols and deputized white American citizens who were empowered by the state to police black, brown, indigenous bodies, mm-hmm. and modern-day police forces. I mean, and the difference, of course, is that they're intensely and absurdly militarized mm-hmm. now, which we saw in Ferguson, where you saw people marching with placards and raised fists, facing down tanks and all kinds of military equipment that you might see on a battleground, but not on a suburban street. Mm-hmm. So that particular narrative, and also what it does is expands our notion. I had a conversation with one of the leading Ferguson activists, DeRay McKesson, and we talked about the idea of those particular activists putting their bodies on the line. And he pushed back even against that notion. He said, what black and brown people do you know who are not putting their bodies on the line simply by virtue of living and existing mm-hmm. in spaces where people aren't accustomed to seeing them? Mm-hmm.
Interesting. Yeah. Mm-hmm. Yeah. So, you know, I think that as a nation, we're still really grappling with how to analyze and understand violence that's cloaked in illegal authority. And the successful criminalization of racial and ethnic minorities means that, you know, it really took children in cages to shine a light on the brutality of our current immigration policies. And it's unfortunate that, you know, thousands of people have died because of immigration policies that claim that deterrence, you know, if you make the cost of trying to immigrate into the United States, literally people dying in the desert, that people will stop coming. And so those policies of deterrence have been leading to death and leading to human rights abuses since the mid-1990s. And so, you know, the pervasiveness of how hard it is actually to raise public mm-hmm. Concern is something that I see happening today. And if we think historically, you know, there's been a lot of work done to create this myth of the American West, that, you know, that Native Americans, indigenous populations, ethnic Mexicans are the antagonists of Anglo colonization and success and capital. And so there's, you know, the logics of manifest destiny that call for the need to brutally police people who are deemed to be the antagonists of progress is a narrative that we're still living with. And, you know, the roots of the policing that I study in the early 20th century, you know, the Texas Rangers didn't just become violent overnight. They practiced violent policing and genocidal violence on indigenous people in what is now Texas. And they also worked to arrest people who were traveling through Texas to Mexico to escape slavery. And many of the Texas Rangers that I study also fought during the Spanish-American War and were, you know, learned brutal policing in wartime and then brought that home. And so this kind of militarization of the border, the militarization of police, and people, racial and ethnic minorities, who really see themselves as the antagonists of progress narratives, really is something that we still have to come to terms with today.
I would just like to add something in terms of these narratives of power and outside of power, in terms of even the narrative, the current narrative of how change happens. When I was researching the book, you know, I'd hear from people who had been in the administration talking about, well, you know, we saw this happening and we decided to do this. And it was sort of trying to make invisible all the work and the bodies on the line and the bodies being out there on, you know, at the border, infiltrating detention centers and all these different ways that young people of color had been bringing this issue to the forefront, and it sort of was being changed into a narrative of somehow, you know, the government sort of decided it was time to change. And I found that interesting mm-hmm. and you know, mm-hmm. slightly disturbing mm-hmm. How much that narrative sort of could so easily become the official narrative that in 10 years we might read in textbooks.
Mm-hmm. I think one of the constant dangers when we talk about racism is that the discussion can get a little heady, right? And that, you know, when we talk about very real, complex structures of power and deployed strategies against marginalized communities, I think sometimes what gets lost in there is the very corporal effects of racism, right? The physicality of oppression, the breaking of bones, the lynchings that are very real, and even the trauma and the physical trauma that comes from activism that you point out in your book. I mean, some of your activists became so ill because they were dealing with this trauma of fighting for their relative not to be deported, of living in constant fear. And so I wonder if you can talk a little bit about the process and why you chose in each of your books to talk about the very physical dangers of racism. And we can start with you, Laura.
Well, I think it's as you say that there is a very physical toll that happens, a mental toll that we don't see, but the result is going to permeate across our country in terms of people's ability to engage in their neighborhoods with their families, domestic abuse, addiction, and just our ability to succeed and move forward. And if we don't acknowledge that, you know, we as a nation are hurting, so stepping way back. But obviously for the individuals, it is incredibly, incredibly weighty to sustain a movement over time because of this toll. And I wanted to explain that because I think there was also even guilt, survivor's guilt, and guilt of people who needed to step away for their mental health and that trauma. And I wanted to expose that because I think that's just something that people who don't have to deal with this on a regular basis never think about. They think, wow, that kid's so brave. And they don't think about how after that kid stood up and told their story to of the fear and the oppression, watching their parents be taken away, you know, after they stood up in front of the senators and then the lights went down and they went home and they vomited and they, you know, just went and were crying all day because they were having to relive that trauma every day. And I think it's important as we ask people to tell their stories that we are very respectful of the pain and the toll it takes to retell that.
And I think that's one difference between this movement and previous movements is there is quite a bit of discussion devoted to self-care, mm-hmm. that you need to take a moment and care for your body. And this isn't introduced into the conversation, but all we have to do is look at Martin Luther King. You know, he was 39 when he died, but, you know, probably at the insides of a 60-year-old man or older, because that self-care wasn't quite a priority in the movement at that time. But I'm equally interested in, you know, we're aware of these dangers and risks to the body, and we know that they are daily. I mean, if you look at the news today, you'll see a news article about a young man who knocked on a door and asked for directions. And the response was a shotgun, which is not very different from the young man who missed his school bus and wandered in the wrong neighborhood and was shot at. And even more recently, the 9-year-old boy, a white woman in a bodega, called the police a couple days ago and said, "I want to report a sexual assault. This 9-year-old boy grabbed my rear end."
And what happened is his backpack
security grazed. Security footage shows he walked past her and his backpack brushed the back of her.
You're right.
And she turned it into an incident by accusing him of, her phrase, sexual assault. Right. So what the other thing that I'm interested in, and I write about in the book in addition to that, is I am very intrigued by the idea or the extent to which people in dark bodies police their own bodies on behalf of the larger culture. So I critique myself. How often do I do that? And I call it discrete citizenship, right? I don't want to be invisible, but I actually don't want to be visible either. I actually want to be left alone. I want to be able to walk down the street, shop, study, work, labor, whatever it is I do. And it's not quite near constant, but I want to assure you that I'm not exaggerating. Maybe 3 days ago, I got off the Brookline Village T-stop where I live. It's nighttime. There's one other person. It's a white woman. She's about 30 years old. She's right in front of me. She's walking at a pace similar to mine, so I know I'm going to be close to her. So I do what I've done for 50 years. I cross the street so that I wouldn't be close to her, so there wouldn't be any misunderstanding. I have 4 sons. They're all trained to do the same, cross the street. So remarkably, though, maybe about a half block And during the course of our walk, she suddenly crosses the street in front of me. Huh. Gets right in front of me. And I remember thinking, wow, this has never happened before. But then I looked back across the street, and there were two black boys, maybe 15, 16-year-old, a couple of Brookline teens. And she had crossed the street so abruptly and so fast to get away from them that, you know, she nearly hobbled herself. You know, so it's like this narrative continues to reveal itself to me on a regular basis. So it's something that concerns me, not just the impact of the body, but the perceived impact of the body. We all saw Philando Castile die live on Facebook. So it's once you've seen that, you can't unsee it, right? So it does begin to govern you and police you. So I worry that it has expanded to such an extent that we are policed, but to a certain extent, we police ourselves. Mm-hmm. And it does constrict how we live.
Mm-hmm. For you, Monica, can you talk about the narrative of the body in your book? Mm-hmm.
Yeah, well, I want to echo the caution that I tried to use in writing about histories of racial violence, and particularly about describing the violence. Mm-hmm. And in my classes, I use different accounts of the same event. So a newspaper article that's celebrating a lynching alongside an article in The Crisis that is condemning the lynching and describing it as a moral outrage, because the use of the sensationalization of violence was used in both cases for different ends. Mm-hmm. And so on the one hand, it was troubling to read accounts of widows who had to, on multiple occasions, testify and give depositions about the violence that were suffered by their husbands that were murdered, and so describing the injuries to the body, describing where they were shot, and that was something that they had to do repeatedly. It reminds you of the toll that it takes for people to seek justice and to try to describe the loss of humanity. And to see the complete opposite in the state records. And so I open the book with a description of a father who's searching through the South Texas landscape looking for his son. And a common practice was that people were killed in the rural landscape. And so there was no evidence of the death unless the remains were found. And so I was careful to think about how to write these histories of violence so that I wasn't, I had one reader who kept saying, you know, you need to be more like Cormac McCarthy, you know, more grit. And I really wanted to hold back from that because what I wanted people to pay attention to was the loss of life, the names of the people who were taken, and the mourning that happened in the aftermath. And so, you know, but I think about, you know, how these families interacted with the dead, and the account of the Poitevin massacre, which happened in January 1918, it was an 11-year-old boy, Juan Bonilla Flores, who was tasked by the military to identify the remains of his father and his neighbors and his relatives, and that stayed with him, and he suffered from flashbacks for the rest of his life. He was institutionalized in 1950 and didn't speak English. So he's not only in a mental institution, but he's being treated by people who don't speak Spanish. And that learning that history from somebody like Benita Alvarado, who told me and shared her family history with me, gave me a sense of how much work historians have to do to make sure that we don't assume that histories of violence and injustice heal. That heals with time, right? That just a matter of time can heal these wounds. Mm. And when you pay attention to how communities were impacted by this violence, you get the sense of how, on a familial level, people were impacted. And I've come across cases where witnesses committed suicide. Mm. And that is something that, you know, if you're thinking about chronicling a list of people impacted by the violence, you have to do more than a body count. To try to understand how this violence shaped communities and generations.
Mm-hmm. All of your books deal with this sense of reckoning, right? That it's past due for the U.S. to have a reckoning with its own systems. What would that reckoning look like for you all, do you think? I imagine that it would be a disavowing of the conventional history that's taught in Texas schools, for example, that explains or that describes the period that you studied as a period of progress instead of state violence. I wonder what it would what does that reckoning look like, and what is the work that needs to be done by white allies?
Right. I think there's, I look at it as almost twofold, and they come together. And one is a reckoning at a social cultural level, because I believe that that change drives policy. And I do think we've already seen it, and there is a backlash, because that's what happens when you try to change the narrative. But, you know, just the young people, Harath Andrade, this young girl who was up in the Senate gallery looking down in 2010 with hundreds of other undocumented brown immigrant youth over the Senate of mostly old white men who were voting and forcing them to see them as part of the civic society, that is a reckoning in and of itself. And the changes that are happening in the media, the depictions of undocumented immigrant youth, the fact that Grey's Anatomy has a whole episode dedicated to a med student who has DACA, you know, protection, but is afraid of being deported. Those things feel frivolous, but they actually are forcing America to have broader America to have these discussions. So that's one plane where I feel like we have started, and we can all continue to work. And then obviously on the policy side, we have people who have been in this country for a long time. There are people who are coming in. There needs to be a change. And in this case, I do think the system is broken. Mm-hmm. I don't think it's even working as people who it is working in some ways as people wanted it to, mm-hmm.
And you're referring to the immigration system.
To the immigration system,
right?
Yes.
Which has a different origin than
it does.
Policing.
But yes and no, because there certainly are policies that very much are connected to race in terms of how and who obviously we let into this country. So I think that change needs to happen. But I mean, honestly, where that change is going to come from is who is in Capitol Hill and who can make those changes, and people who are committed to actually changing policy. And what people can do is make sure that those people get there, people on both sides of the aisle who are willing to come together. And so if you can and do have a vote and you don't exercise it right now, I think that is official negligence. And if you're not getting others to get involved as well.
I think we're seeing evidence of intermittent reckonings. Like, for example, yesterday the Chancellor of the University of North Carolina at Chapel Hill issued an apology for the university's role in the slave trade and acknowledged that the university probably would not exist without the financial benefits that it got from the slave trade. So on the academic level, we're seeing some of these things happening. But we also have to be really critical even of the idea of coming to terms with these particular historical and present realities. If we look at policing, for example, responses to police brutality in previous years have resulted in civilian oversight boards, seeing the institution of what they call community-oriented policing around the country. And we often point to these as evidence as sort of a step forward, but the truth is they haven't resulted in any substantive changes in the treatment of black, brown, and indigenous bodies around the United States. So we can't even point to that as evidence of a reckoning. So I would go even farther and say we really have to seriously consider the idea of constructively dismantling the police system as it exists.
Hmm.
So.
Yeah.
Yes to that. Well, you know, for me, the work is multifaceted. And so reckoning for the descendants that I interviewed in the book and that I've been working with is really trying to address this gap between what's understood by professional historians, academics, the field of history, and what's understood and taught by the public, and the role of cultural institutions, museums in particular, and public history, the Texas Historical Commission, for example. And so, you know, the history of racial violence that I write about has been documented before. It's not new. And as we were discussing earlier, people in Texas whose lives and families have been impacted by this know this history. And so what what we're really trying to do is encourage cultural institutions like the Texas State History Museum to participate in shaping public understanding, to have a truthful accounting of the past. And that required, and we had an exhibit called Life and Death on the Border, and just this 10-week span of the exhibit being up at the Texas State History Museum, the flagship museum, over 40,000 people came to see that exhibit. And what was so striking to me was that many of the people who I spoke with were coming not because they wanted to consume a history that they didn't know, but they were coming to see the state finally acknowledge this period of racial violence and the roles of governors and senators and state police in this period of terror. I'm also working with descendants in the Texas Historical Commission and other professors to unveil historical markers. Because in the book, I also write about the way that public history has been used to create these myths and to perpetuate this criminalization. But I am also hesitant and very conscious that, you know, if we talk about histories of racial violence as a thing of the past, then it gives some people license to say this historical marker is progress, closure,
right,
done.
Yeah. Right.
And it's striking to me that the counties where we are unveiling historical markers are also counties along the border where you have immigration detention centers. And I really do think that nationally people don't understand how integrated the policing system is, not just, you know, local law enforcement and state police, but immigration police. So when there is an effort by Congress to stop the use of private prisons to house American citizens, private prisons are then used to detain immigrants and to detain refugees, you know, who are being denied due process and who are being denied asylum. And so I think that, you know, the Border Patrol is the second largest police force in the country behind the NYPD. And so I think that in terms of the histories of policing, in the book, I look at this moment where in 1919, the Texas Rangers are not only policing ethnic Mexicans, but they're also policing anti-lynching activists and members of the NAACP. And so the suppression of multiple racial and ethnic groups is a practice of terror that is felt through policing. And that is something that is a legacy that we are living with today. But unfortunately, the on the ground work of activists have been successful in trying to bridge Black Lives Matter movements with the DACA movement and the Dreamer movement and rights for people who are seeking asylum in the United States. But publicly, we tend to segregate these as two different issues, and I think it's a detriment to our ability. We really need public accountability to transform policing and to stop human rights abuses that are ongoing today.
Mm-hmm. You know, it was interesting what you just said, Monica, the last part, because I remember being at the United We Dream, the largest undocumented immigrant youth organization conference back in 2016, And one of the speakers, Jorge Ramos, who's, you know, very influential, was saying something that is often said about undocumented immigrant communities: we're not criminals, we're immigrants. And leaders of the undocu-black organization were raising their hands and saying, you know, what is this narrative? We're not criminals, we're immigrants. Like, who's the criminal then? Who are you saying? What is the subtle message here that we're not them? And there was a lot of internal reckoning, and there's a lot of conversation. And I found that really heartening to see that level of soul-searching and conversation about, as you're saying, about what, you know, prison reform is and the private prisons and all of that. And I think that now needs allies need to really start looking at that in questions and challenging their own perceptions as well about sort of that those dichotomies, false dichotomies between, you know, the good immigrant and the criminal.
It's the politics of respectability, which I write about a lot in the book. When an African American is an unarmed African American is killed by the police, there is this effort on the left to display the victim in his full humanity. You know, he was a straight A student. He was about to go to college, et cetera. Valuable effort, but at the same time, it sort of displaces this argument that it doesn't matter. What matters is the dark body, and it's the dark body that was slain. And typically, part of the police effort to subvert this narrative, at least in communities, is they say they're going to investigate themselves first of all, in an effort to, and here's my favorite phrase, to restore trust. You can't restore trust where it didn't exist. Yeah. Then that's followed by a public relations campaign in which they introduce an ice cream truck to an impoverished community and say, we're giving out free popsicles on this corner, right? And our truck, well, that was a bait truck. So that was a little, quite a different scenario, but still, both techniques of deception, I think. Mm-hmm.
So I want to talk about sort of the connection in the structures of power that all of your books deal with. So for your book, Laura, we really get a sense of U.S. foreign policy and U.S. imperialism in a way that forces migration and that creates standards of living or creates conditions that add to migration. And then in your book, Monica, we learn that the same tactics, the same military tactics in Texas that were used to suppress ethnic Mexicans in Texas was the same tactics that were used, imperialistic tactics that were used when the U.S. was expanding its reach in Puerto Rico and mm-hmm. Guam and Hawaii. Mm-hmm. And it was sort of the same military strategies. And we also learn that they were using Jim Crow and in Texas that they called them Juan Crow laws to suppress not only Mexicans, but also enslaved people, enslaved African Americans, who would try to escape into Mexico, but who were killed and lynched as well. And so it's like different extensions of the same power that we see, right, in imperialistic foreign policy at home. I wonder mm-hmm. if you can talk about that a little bit.
Yeah, it's a great question. Well, I think the place like Texas is so interesting for a number of reasons. I mean, I grew up in South Texas, so, you know, the racial politics that I grew up learning were so dynamic, and I think there's a lot of misconceptions about what it's like to live in the South and how people navigate. But, you know, Texas as a historian is also so fascinating because it has these converging histories. So the histories of colonization and conquest, the histories of slavery, they intersect and converge in Texas. And so, you know, as a historian trying to track how the ideas of white supremacy that justify the enslavement of people, the ideas of white supremacy that justify genocidal violence against indigenous bodies, that goes on to shape, you know, the policing that we see in the 20th century and the denial of justice for people who try to correct that kind of violence. And so it's, for me, you know, that requires actually studying who the police themselves are and learning about Texas Ranger captains who had served in the Spanish-American War in the Philippines, for example, and bragged about how many people in the Philippines that they murdered, and then using that same kind of logic in South Texas, or a U.S. Army captain who, you know, was organizing slaughters of Apaches in Arizona, then coming to South Texas and using that sort of military strategy. And this is also really heightened in the early 20th century because it's a time of war. And so the United States government sends 100,000 troops to the U.S.-Mexico border, primarily in Texas and in California, and they're training and learning how to use the newest military technologies, machine guns, tanks, trench warfare. There's a prison camp for Mexican refugees who fled the Civil War in Mexico during the Mexican Revolution, and they're put behind barbed wire fence in a prison camp. And there are some accounts that say that those fences were electrified. Mm-hmm. And so it's a moment in terms of thinking about what public rhetoric and calls for violent policing, how new military technologies of policing then are used without raising much public concern. And so I think these intersecting histories of slavery, colonization, war, and the consequences of criminalizing entire racial and ethnic groups, you see the brutality that then can be used to target these groups.
Mm-hmm. And I look at, in the book, I look at the tracing of, well, I try to connect it to the state's capitalist needs. Mm-hmm. So after emancipation, there was a loss of captive unpaid labor. So all across the South in particular, there was suddenly the implementation of anti-loitering laws. And they basically just scooped up truckloads of black people wherever they were, charged them with loitering, sentenced them to absurdly long sentences, and put them on labor farms like most notoriously Parchment Farm in Mississippi, which was a giant cotton plantation. So these people are now criminals. And then they are leased. So that's where convict leasing comes from. Mm-hmm. So these large landholders and manufacturers then have these captive laborers. And we still see this in places like Florida, Alabama, Georgia, even Michigan, where private prisons have been really allowed to prevail. And so they make our T-shirts, they make our underwear, they pick fruit for Whole Foods, they do all these things. And it's you can draw a line between those initial anti-loitering laws, which come out of Jim Crow, the black codes, to modern notions. And it's also connected to outside of the law, this idea of people being out of place and being up to no good. So one of the things I talk about in the book is I trace the mobility of the phrase up to no good. An idea that dark bodies in spaces where we're not accustomed to seeing them are therefore worthy of suspicion and intervention, legal intervention.
You wanna?
All right. So we're going to start questions now. We have a microphone up here if you'd like to come up and ask a question.
The correct term is illegal alien, not undocumented immigrants. That's a nonsense Orwellian term that should be done away with immediately. I know you have your allies in the leftist media, but it speaks of your dishonesty. As to crime, racial crime, crimes against blacks, I want to see how honest you people really are.
You people, I love it.
On this panel.
You're mansplaining already. We don't need it. We don't need it. You have nothing constructive to contribute to the conversation, so you need to step away.
You have the honesty.
Step aside. Step aside.
That black violent crime.
I will not indulge in the fallacy.
Rape, armed robbery, far exceeds the reverse.
Can someone call the police? Do we have security?
Don't admit it.
Do we have security?
Nothing you say here can be believed.
Come on, we have security following me through Walgreens, and we get to let this guy spout this invective? He needs to move. Thank you.
He shows up in every...
Ah, okay. Yeah, he moves through spaces unmolested. It must be a wonderful thing.
Can't be the only question. There's 150 people here.
Thank you all so much. I had a couple of comments, things that struck me in the presentations. One is also just to mention another book. Perhaps people know of it. I've just started reading it, Bluebird, Bluebird, an African-American author and writing about Texas and an African-American who is in the Texas Rangers. And a lot of these themes seem to be woven into a kind of a detective story. So it's a very interesting piece. I'm very interested in what you're saying. I was thinking about the markers and just appreciating your sensibilities about it. I was in Eastern Europe this summer, and I didn't get to Berlin, Western Europe, but in planning a trip, read about the markers from the Holocaust that have been placed in, like on streets that apparently are very powerful. While many people think of going to former camps and concentration camps as a place to see the history and the Holocaust, that apparently scattered, you know, cobblestones or something that identify a place where somebody has died is quite powerful because people encounter it, and it's not that you're going someplace else, you encounter it. So I thought the idea of your markers seemed very interesting. And I just also thought of the case at Smith College of the young woman who was
reading,
you know, reading and your comments about being out of place and what that can, you know, how that happens. Thank you very much.
Yeah. Jews were also, you know, considered illegal citizens in Nazi Germany. So,
and I've been learning, and other Jews have been learning, in terms of the immigration story of that there is a story of Jews from Europe illegally coming into the United States when they couldn't get in, you know, seeking asylum and safety that isn't really talked about or known very much.
Mm-hmm. Thank you.
Yeah, I'll respond really quickly to thank you for that invitation. And in the book, you know, this isn't just a Mexican white story. And so actually some of the violence that I include comes at the hands of Mexican Texas Rangers. And so, and some of the people who are standing up for justice and calling for justice and calling for an end to the violence are white attorneys and white U.S. soldiers and white sheriffs. And so what I do in the book is try to expose how much, you know, the histories of how much racial terror impacts entire communities. It doesn't only impact racial minorities. And in terms of thinking about the markers, you know, I'm working actively with a group of professors in a nonprofit called Refusing to Forget. And I invited descendants to participate. We gathered in 2013 to figure out how to commemorate the peak of anti-Mexican violence in 2015. I wanted them to be a part of the conversation. And we as a group of professors said, well, we'll have an exhibit somewhere, you know, maybe at UT Austin probably, and we'll probably have, maybe we can raise funds for a monument. Maybe that should be in Austin too, or somewhere on the border, maybe Brownsville. And it was really the descendants who said, you know, we have been actively commemorating these acts of violence on our own, and it's time for the state to participate. And if the state doesn't participate, if they continue to, then that means that they're continuing to disavow this violence. And so that really then started our efforts to collaborate and to find allies and people within cultural institutions who want to do this work. And so that's been an important part of having a public conversation about what does reckoning look like and how do you create spaces where public mourning can happen. And so for residents, some of what they're asking for is very small. It's huge and small in what I think they could ask for. But just to have, for example, a marker that says that this act was a tragedy, that it was wrong, and to have the names of the victims, I think that's a small thing to ask for, and yet it has taken years of work. And in some cases, there are some local residents in Texas who say that the men, that Mexicans of this era, were rapists and thieves and bandits, and they don't deserve a marker. And so, you know, the comments that we just heard resonates because that there's widespread sentiment that understands that. So the work that we have to do to reckon with this is a lot. We have a lot of work to do.
One of the things that I've really enjoyed throughout this panel is that it seems like within activities that are happening to try to at least amplify some kind of a more equal narrative is that there has been collaboration between different groups within the Black community and Dreamers. And I'm just wondering, because another big conversation that seems to be pervasive today is the talk of intersectionality. And I think it's obviously a very valuable one, but I also think that it does have the potential to create divisions. And so I'm just wondering, one, just kind of broadly, how you guys feel about that, if it does have, if it's a more beneficial way to go about activism, to always keep that in mind, or if it does have the potential to harm these causes.
Intersectionality is a term coined by Kimberly Crenshaw, who's a Columbia professor, talking about responding to levels of oppression by acknowledging one's overlapping identities. And I do think that dissent sometimes emerges from it. Like there's quite a bit of debate and dialogue between white feminists and Black feminists right now about intersectionality. But I think it's necessary, and I do think it's ultimately constructive. And the way that it's valuable, I think, to people like me is that it reminds me to not always place myself at the center of the narrative, right? So the world doesn't revolve around me. There's all these particular struggles, particular issues, and everybody has some issue. And it forces me to acknowledge that when I want to have a moment where it's all about me, right? And so and so I think intersectionality in particular, for me speaking personally, is really valuable in that regard because it encourages each of us to say, okay, you do inhabit these other identities. There are other aspects of your personality, and it's a way to expand your empathy. And so I appreciate the way Monica was saying, you know, it's not just Mexicans and whites, it's this and that, and right. it's very easy to sort of compartmentalize these things when in reality we actually right. can't. So I think it's very yeah. helpful in that regard.
I also think it's organic. So to deny it is to deny our humanity. Mm. If you're a Dominican woman who's in the country illegally and has black skin, you are going to face different oppressions and different experiences that someone who is a white Argentinian who's also undocumented is not going to face. Mm-hmm. And so to make someone choose is to make them sort of cut themselves in half. Mm-hmm. At the same time, I think, you know, there are times when we need to focus in. I
sure.
mean, if you're
sure.
a black man, there are experiences you have that you need to...
That are solely your own.
Sure. And then, yeah. you know, yeah. so you need to be able to do both and have those separate spaces and also to be able to come together. But also when we're coming together, making sure that it's not a repetition of the traditional power structures where, you know, the white man or woman is necessarily dominating that coming together. And that's something to be conscious of as well.
Hi. One, I'm sure I express the sentiments of a lot of people in this room when I want to apologize for that man who disrupted this. He does show up at a lot of things that seek to amplify the voices of, like, women and people of color. I've seen him at many things, and he's always really hostile. So apologies for that. I wanted to ask, I don't necessarily know that any of you sort of dive into the modern criminal justice system, but you were talking about the history of policing and kind of reckoning with the criminal justice system. And I wondered if you could express some of your thoughts on the concept of restorative justice, which is something I'm hearing a lot more talk and reading a lot of, like, think pieces about, and its potential to sort of replace our existing criminal justice system. And if you have positive feelings towards that, or if you think there are pitfalls, and I'd just love to hear your thoughts on it.
Can you give us, like, two sentences on restorative justice?
So, yes, and I'm not remotely well-versed in the topic, but my understanding of restorative justice is that rather than a punitive system, restorative justice seeks to bring together, I read that they don't use the word victim, the survivor and the perpetrator, and have some way where the perpetrator, like, admits culpability to the survivor, and there's meant to be some sort of coming together and reckoning. And I've read about it specifically in regards to sexual assault cases where traditional justice is typically not available, but I've also read it in larger cases just as a suggestion to replace, like, our current punitive system. So yeah. as someone who doesn't know that much about it, I wondered if you had thoughts.
Yeah, well, I would recommend, thank you, it's a great question. I can't speak to restorative justice in the sense of how that could maybe stop, you know, prosecution of people or relying on the criminal justice system in that way. But I'm familiar with the work of human rights lawyers and civil rights lawyers. For example, Margaret Burnham. If people don't know about the Civil Rights and Restorative Justice Project here, it's led by Margaret Burnham, a pillar of human rights law. But, you know, I'm more familiar with the use of Truth and Reconciliation Commissions mm-hmm. to try to shed light and bring truth to the public, but also the use of restorative justice in the case for histories of racial violence in which so much time has passed that there's nobody to prosecute. People have died. And so some of the really exceptional work that she's done, for example, is to use markers to designate a history. And one of the cases that really spoke to me was actually having a death certificate changed. There was an African-American civil rights activist that was murdered, and the death certificate for him, you know, explained that he was shot 3 times, but he died from shock. As opposed to being murdered. And so they have reopened over 500 cases of civil rights activists from the 60s and 70s, really from 1930s through, and are seeking justice in other forms. And so in some cases, they have successfully brought prosecuted assailants or aggressors. And in one case, they successfully prosecuted a police department in Mississippi who they were able to prove had been colluding with the Ku Klux Klan. And so I'm familiar with using restorative justice to try to find ways to reckon with acts of violence when prosecutions aren't available. But I'm looking forward to learning more. Thanks for bringing that up today.
Laura, did you want to say something?
This might seem off topic, but I hope it's not, because it's not directly restorative justice. But there are more than 1.1 million people in Florida who have been convicted of felonies, who have served their time and do not have the vote. And I bring this up because, you know, obviously covering immigration, there are a lot of people who don't have the vote, but there are a lot of American citizens who are disenfranchised. And as part of a restoration of their rights and restorative justice to bringing them back into our civic community, and also, as you were saying, to reckoning and trying to change the narrative, we need to bring those people back. And that is something that allies and others can do, is to work on places to ensure that those in this country who do already have the basic right to a vote are allowed to exercise it in this country.
Okay, thank you. Well, I got a sign saying that the session is over, but so sorry. But the authors, we have their books available. They're for sale. They'll be here if you'd like to say hi. Thank you so much.